1776. Most people, when they hear that year, think of one document, the American Declaration of Independence, July 4th. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
But 3 months earlier, in March of that same year, a Scottish philosopher named Adam Smith published a different document. One that would change the world just as profoundly, though in a completely different direction.
An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. 5 books. 900 pages. The founding text of modern economics.
And I want to start by saying, I don't think it's a coincidence that both documents appeared in the same year. They're products of the same intellectual moment, the Enlightenment, the conviction that human reason can redesign social institutions from first principles.
The Declaration of Independence said, people have the right to govern themselves. The Wealth of Nations said, economies work best when they're not strangled by kings, guilds, and monopoly trading companies.
Both were acts of liberation. Political liberation on one side of the Atlantic. Economic liberation articulated on the other. Same DNA, different domain.
And 250 years later, the Wealth of Nations is still the founding text of modern economics. Every major economist who came after Smith is in dialogue with him.
Ricardo, Mill, Marx, Keynes, Hayek, Friedman. You cannot understand any of them without understanding Smith first. He set the agenda that everyone else has been arguing about ever since.
We talk sometimes about the canon of economics, the works that define the discipline. Smith is at the top, not as a historical curiosity, but as a living argument that people are still making and still fighting over.
And that's what makes this episode both necessary and complicated. Because the Adam Smith that exists in public debate is a constructed figure, assembled from selected quotes, stripped of context, turned into an ideology.
Which is why we're here. We've done Marx, we've done Hayek, we covered the Austrian school, and in every single one of those episodes, Smith kept appearing as the original reference point.
Time to go back to the source.
And here's what makes this episode necessary. Adam Smith is one of the most misquoted, most misrepresented thinkers in the entire history of ideas.
His most famous phrase, the invisible hand, appears exactly once in the entire book. Once. In a very specific, very narrow context that has essentially nothing to do with how it gets used.
And the free market ideologues who have claimed Smith as their patron saint, who put his name on think tanks, cite him in every argument for deregulation, would be genuinely horrified by many of his actual positions.
So today, who was Adam Smith really? What did the Wealth of Nations actually argue? And why does any of this matter in 2026, 250 years on?
Let's start with the man himself. Adam Smith was born in 1723 in Kirkcaldy, a small coastal town in Scotland. His father died before he was born. He was raised by his mother, to whom he remained intensely close his entire life.
He studied at Glasgow University, which was at the time genuinely one of the great intellectual institutions in the world. And his teacher there was Francis Hutcheson.
Hutcheson tends to get forgotten, but shouldn't. He's the person who coined the greatest happiness for the greatest number. Before Bentham, that phrase is almost universally attributed to Bentham. It was Hutcheson.
And Smith absorbed Hutcheson's moral philosophy deeply. The conviction that human beings have genuine social instincts, that we naturally care about others, not just ourselves. That stays with Smith for the rest of his life and career.
Then Oxford, Balliol College, on a scholarship, and Smith hated it, profoundly.
He wrote later that the professors had given up even the pretense of teaching. Oxford in the 1740s was intellectually inert compared to Glasgow. He basically taught himself by reading in the Bodleian Library,
which, given what he eventually produced, was clearly sufficient. He came back to Scotland, lectured at Edinburgh, and was appointed professor of moral philosophy at Glasgow.
Note that title carefully. Not professor of economics. The discipline of economics didn't exist. He was a moral philosopher. That framing shapes everything about how he approaches markets.
And before he wrote a single word about markets or trade, he published his first major work, the book that almost everyone who cites Smith has never read.
The Theory of Moral Sentiments. 1759.
What does it actually argue?
TMS is about sympathy, but in a precise, philosophical sense. When we see another person suffer or rejoice, we imaginatively place ourselves in their position. We feel something of what they feel. And this capacity for imaginative fellow feeling is, Smith argues, the foundation of all moral judgment.
And then the impartial spectator. This is one of Smith's most original ideas. When we evaluate our own behavior, we don't just ask, "What do I want?" We step back and ask, "How would a well-informed, impartial observer judge this?"
That internal judge is the conscience, theorized with real philosophical precision. It's not just sentiment, it's a cognitive operation of imaginative self-evaluation.
So the person who wrote The Wealth of Nations was not a cold-blooded advocate for unfettered self-interest. He was a moral philosopher who had spent years thinking carefully about sympathy, social bonds, and ethical judgment. That context is absolutely essential.
The Scottish Enlightenment context matters too. Smith wasn't working in isolation. His best friend was David Hume, arguably the greatest philosopher Scotland has ever produced. The same generation produced James Watt, who transformed the steam engine. Adam Ferguson, who invented sociology.
Edinburgh and Glasgow in the mid-18th century were, by most measures, the intellectual capitals of the Western world for a generation. It's a remarkable concentration of talent in a small country.
And that context shaped Smith's instincts fundamentally. He came out of a community where intellectual life was genuinely collaborative, where philosophers challenged each other, refined each other's ideas, held each other to account.
Hume and Smith's friendship was both personal and intellectually formative. Hume challenged Smith on philosophy, on religion, on everything. And Smith pushed back. That kind of rigorous intellectual friction is visible in how carefully Smith qualifies his claims throughout The Wealth of Nations. He's not dogmatic. He's genuinely trying to figure things out.
And then Smith got an unusual opportunity. He became a tutor to the young Duke of Buccleuch and spent several years traveling in France and Switzerland.
He met Voltaire in Geneva. He met Quesnay and Turgot, the French physiocrats, who were developing their own critique of mercantilism. He absorbed the French anti-mercantilist argument directly.
The physiocrats thought the real source of national wealth was agricultural production. Smith disagreed with their specific theory, but he took their fundamental hostility to mercantilist restrictions with him back to Scotland.
He came back and spent 12 years writing The Wealth of Nations. 12 years. Published 1776. Then revised it 4 more times before he died in 1790.
And on his deathbed, he had his private library of unpublished notes and manuscripts burned. Because he considered them unfinished. He held himself to an extraordinary standard.
All right, the book itself. The core ideas. What does it actually say?
Chapter 1 opens with one of the most famous passages in economic history. The Pin Factory.
Walk us through it.
Smith describes a small manufacturing operation. 10 workers. Each doing one specialized task, one draws the wire, another straightens it, another cuts it, another points it, another grinds the top to fit the head. 10 men working with specialized tools and practice motions.
Together, 48,000 pins per day.
One man doing all of it himself, from raw wire to finished pin, might produce 20 on a good day. That's the division of labor.
And Smith's argument is that this specialization, the systematic fragmentation of tasks, is the fundamental source of economic growth. When you perform one operation thousands of times a day, your dexterity increases. You stop losing time switching between tasks. You start inventing small improvements.
The productivity gains are extraordinary and they compound. This is still true in 2026. More true, arguably, than it was in 1776.
The global supply chain for a modern smartphone is Smith's Pin Factory at planetary scale. Components designed in California, manufactured in Taiwan, assembled in China, software built across a dozen countries. The specialization is staggering and so is the productivity.
But, and this is the part that never gets quoted, Smith also warned, deeply and explicitly, about the costs of division of labor.
He wrote that a worker who spends his entire working life doing a single repetitive task becomes, and I'm quoting him directly, as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human creature to become.
That sentence is in The Wealth of Nations, the same book. He celebrated the productivity of specialization and warned simultaneously that it could damage the human beings doing the work.
And his solution was publicly funded education. He called explicitly on government to provide basic schooling for poor children, as a counterweight to the intellectual degradation of repetitive labor.
In 1776, in the same book as the pin factory argument, he saw both sides of the picture.
Now the invisible hand, the phrase everyone knows, walk me through the actual passage.
Book 4, Chapter 2. Smith is asking, will merchants prefer to invest their capital at home or send it overseas? His answer is that merchants generally prefer to keep capital nearby, they feel more secure knowing their investment is close at hand.
Right, and what follows from that preference?
By investing domestically rather than abroad, the merchant inadvertently supports more domestic employment and output than he would if he sent his capital overseas. Smith observes, even though the merchant is acting from pure self-interest, he accidentally benefits the home economy.
And the famous phrase, the merchant intends only his own gain, and he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention.
That's the full context. It is not a general theory of market optimality. It's not even a claim about markets in the abstract. It's a specific observation about one type of investment decision in one specific historical situation.
And Smith used the invisible hand metaphor 3 times across his entire published writing, each time casually, almost as an aside. He almost certainly didn't consider it his central insight.
His actual theory of market coordination is much more careful. It's about competition driving prices toward their natural level. About supply responding to demand over time. About the price system coordinating millions of decisions made by people who will never meet.
The invisible hand became the symbol of the entire free market project. Smith would, I think, have been puzzled by that.
Let's talk about self-interest, because the butcher, brewer, baker passage is genuinely revolutionary and deserves its due.
It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. Before Smith, self-interest was a moral vice, something to be overcome, suppressed, disciplined.
Smith said, you can channel it productively. If markets are genuinely competitive, if information is reasonably available, if there's no monopoly power distorting prices, then self-interest and social benefit align. The butcher wants to profit. To profit, he needs customers. To keep customers, he needs to sell decent meat at a fair price.
His interest and yours align. That's a genuine and powerful insight. It was revolutionary in 1776 and it holds in many circumstances today.
But, and this is critical, Smith absolutely did not say this mechanism works in all circumstances. He was very clear, the alignment depends on competition, on accessible information, on the absence of significant externalities. Remove those conditions, and the mechanism breaks down completely.
That makes him far more sophisticated than the ideology built around him suggests. He understood that markets could fail. He just happened to be writing in an era when the dominant failures were caused by government-sponsored monopolies, not by private market concentration.
Now let's talk about free trade and mercantilism, because understanding Smith's actual target completely changes how you read the book.
Mercantilism was the dominant economic doctrine of the 17th and 18th centuries. The core idea, national wealth consists in gold and silver. To accumulate gold, maximize exports, minimize imports. Trade is zero-sum, one nation wins, another loses.
And the institutional architecture of European economies was built around this logic. The East India Company, a private corporation with a monopoly charter to trade with Asia, its own military, and the power to govern colonial territories. The Navigation Acts. The Wool Guilds. A vast apparatus of monopoly, restriction, and colonial extraction.
Smith demolished it, comprehensively and systematically. Trade is positive sum. When two parties voluntarily exchange, both benefit. A country should produce what it's good at and trade for the rest. The insight Ricardo would formalize as comparative advantage.
And here's the historical context that almost always gets dropped. In 1776, the free trade argument was a radical, progressive position. Smith was attacking the established interests, the East India Company, the merchant guilds, the trading monopolies that used political connections to lock out competition.
He was the challenger, not the establishment. The free market was a revolutionary idea, aimed at the powerful in Smith's time.
Which makes the modern appropriation of Smith as the defender of corporate power so historically bizarre.
Let's get into that directly. The Adam Smith problem, Das Adam Smith problem, as 19th century German scholars called it.
The apparent contradiction, theory of moral sentiment says humans are driven by sympathy and the desire for moral approval. Wealth of Nations says humans act from self-interest. Which is the real Smith?
Modern scholarship says both and they're compatible. They operate at different levels. TMS is about moral psychology, how we form ethical judgments. WN is about how markets function given that humans also have self-interested motivations.
Smith wasn't saying sympathy is false. He was saying markets don't require benevolence to produce social benefit. That's different from saying benevolence doesn't exist.
The deeper problem is political. The Smith invoked by Reagan, Thatcher, and every free market think tank is a very specific constructed image. Deregulation, minimal government, markets as the solution to everything.
Let me just read you some actual quotes from the real book.
Please.
On trade associations, people of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices. He hated cartels.
He was deeply suspicious of the merchant class using government to restrict competition. His villain was the East India Company, a private corporation extracting wealth from millions through monopoly and force.
On corporations and managers, the managers of joint stock companies manage other people's money and cannot be expected to watch over it with the same anxious vigilance with which the partners in a private co-partnery frequently watch over their own.
The principal agent problem. The idea that corporate managers have interests that diverge from the interests of shareholders. Jensen and Meckling got enormous academic credit for this in 1976. Smith had it in 1776.
On wages, masters are always and everywhere in a sort of tacit, but constant and uniform combination, not to raise the wages of labor above their actual rate. He saw the structural power imbalance clearly and said so.
And no society can surely be flourishing and happy, of which the far greater part of the members are poor and miserable. That is Smith, in The Wealth of Nations, not a separate progressive pamphlet.
On taxation, it is not very unreasonable that the rich should contribute to the public expense, not only in proportion to their revenue, but something more than in that proportion. An explicit argument for progressive taxation.
And on public goods, he argued government must provide roads, education, harbors, and institutions because the profit could never repay the expense to any individual, even when they're enormously valuable to society.
That is a market failure argument built into The Wealth of Nations itself. The book that free market advocates use to argue against public spending contains an explicit argument for public spending.
And the section on public institutions isn't a minor footnote. Smith was genuinely thinking through what the state needs to do to make a market economy function, not what it should stay out of as a matter of principle.
The libertarian reading of Smith, Minimal State, Maximum Markets, requires you to skip several hundred pages of the actual text.
Let me steelman the free market reading though, because I don't want us to overcorrect.
Fair.
Smith's central thrust was liberalization. End the guild restrictions. Break up the monopoly trading companies. Let workers move freely. Let prices find their levels. In 1776, with economy strangled by mercantilist apparatus, that was absolutely the right call. And it produced enormous prosperity gains when put into practice.
And he was a pragmatist, not an ideologue. He wasn't saying markets are always right on principle. He was making an empirical argument. Compared to the mercantilist alternative of his era, competitive markets produce better outcomes.
The question is whether that argument translates automatically to every era. And Smith, being an empiricist, would have been the first to say, Check the actual conditions before applying the framework.
Now, Smith versus Marx. This comparison is essential. In our Marx episode, we talked about how Marx read Smith obsessively and built on him. What's the actual relationship?
Both use the labor theory of value, the idea that the value of goods ultimately derives from the labor required to produce them. Smith held this in a qualified form. He knew prices also reflect rent and profit, not just labor. Marx took the labor theory more seriously and used it as the foundation of his exploitation theory.
The key difference, Smith saw competitive markets as ultimately beneficial to everyone, including workers. Marx looked at industrial capitalism a few decades later, when the Industrial Revolution had run much further, and saw systematic exploitation built into the structure.
For Smith, self-interest in competitive markets leads to social benefit. For Marx, self-interest in capitalist markets leads to exploitation and class conflict. Same observations about human motivation, radically different conclusions about the institutional consequences.
But here's what strikes me: Smith's sympathy for labor, his recognition of the power imbalance in wage negotiations, his concern for workers' conditions, his worry about what factory work does to human minds, puts him much closer to Marx in values than to the Chicago School.
They disagreed on the diagnosis and the cure. Smith thought well-structured competitive markets could work for everyone. Marx thought the competitive structure itself generated exploitation. But both of them were genuinely and morally concerned with the actual conditions of working people.
That shared ground gets completely erased when Smith gets recruited into Reaganomics.
Comparative advantage. This is where Smith planted a seed Ricardo harvested. The insight that countries should specialize in what they produce most efficiently, trade for everything else, and both sides gain.
Ricardo formalized it elegantly in 1817 with the cloth and wine example. But the logic is in Smith's attack on mercantilism. And it remains the single most important idea in international economics.
And it's genuinely counterintuitive. Even if one country is better at producing everything than another country, both still gain from specializing and trading. The gains come from relative advantage, not absolute advantage.
Smith saw this intuitively. Ricardo proved it mathematically. And the empirical evidence over two centuries is pretty decisive. Open economies have generally outperformed protectionist ones.
Which is why 2020's wave of protectionism, tariffs, reshoring, economic nationalism, makes reading Smith urgent. He demolished zero-sum trade thinking in 1776. Those arguments haven't expired.
And Smith's surprisingly progressive positions on wealth distribution are worth stating plainly. He was against hereditary privilege. Merit, not birth, should determine economic position. He was contemptuous of landlords. Landlords, like all other men, love to reap where they never sowed.
He supported progressive taxation explicitly. He wanted competitive markets partly because he thought they would generate a larger, more prosperous middle class, not because he thought they would reward the wealthy.
Let's move to 2026. What holds after 250 years? What needs updating? And what would Smith say about the world we're actually living in?
Division of labor and specialization completely holds, more relevant than ever. The productivity gains from global specialization are extraordinary. This is still the most important insight in the book.
The price system as information coordination, Smith's insight that prices aggregate and transmit dispersed knowledge is the same one Hayek made rigorous in 1945. It's as solid as it ever was.
Free trade as positive sum needs urgent rereading. We're living through the biggest wave of protectionism since the 1930s. Trump tariffs, Brexit, deglobalization. Smith's demolition of zero-sum trade thinking needs to be read again.
The agency problem in corporations, completely alive. Every debate about CEO pay, shareholder versus stakeholder capitalism, board accountability, you're arguing about a problem Smith identified in 1776.
Now what needs serious updating? Market structure. This is the biggest challenge for applying Smith's framework today.
Smith assumed relatively competitive markets. Small firms, local markets, guild-based monopoly you could reform away. He could not have imagined platform monopolies.
Google in search, Amazon in retail and cloud, Meta in social networks, Apple on mobile. These are businesses with structural monopoly power arising from network effects and data accumulation. Smith's competitive market framework doesn't map cleanly onto them.
But here's what I keep thinking: Smith would have recognized the problem immediately, even without the formal framework. Because his critique of the East India Company maps almost perfectly onto big tech.
How so?
The East India Company was a private corporation with enormous economic and political power, extracting rents from the economy, using its position to shape the rules that were supposed to govern it. Sound familiar?
Big tech employs former regulators, funds academic research on competition policy, spends enormously on lobbying on antitrust law, shapes the policy environment that's supposed to constrain it. That's regulatory capture. The East India Company did the same thing.
People of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public. Smith would have applied that quote directly to Silicon Valley.
He'd have wanted antitrust enforcement. Not because he loved government intervention, he was genuinely cautious about it, but because competitive markets require actual competition. If the conditions don't exist naturally, you have to enforce them.
Climate change is the other major test of the framework. The invisible hand requires that market prices reflect actual costs of production. Carbon emissions impose enormous costs on the atmosphere and on future generations that never appear in market prices.
Smith understood the concept we now call externalities. He understood that market prices can fail to capture social costs. Would he have supported a carbon tax?
I think yes. He was an empiricist. He'd have looked at the scale of the climate externality and concluded the market failure was too large to ignore.
I'm genuinely uncertain. Smith was cautious about government intervention. He'd seen how badly governments distort markets when given the tools. He might have worried as much about the intervention as the market failure itself.
Maybe. But he was ultimately about outcomes. He wanted prosperity broadly shared. If there was a concrete mechanism, like a carbon price, that corrected a real failure without creating new distortions, I think he'd have supported it pragmatically.
An AI. This is where applying Smith's framework gets genuinely difficult, because it's a situation he couldn't have imagined.
Division of labor taken to its logical extreme, AI systems specialize in cognitive tasks at marginal cost approaching zero. Legal research. Medical image reading. Code writing. Financial analysis. This is specialization beyond anything that existed in 1776 or 1876.
The productivity gains are entirely Smithian. More specialization, more output per unit of input. The pin factory logic applied to intelligence itself. Smith would have been delighted by the productivity story.
But the distributional question is, who captures those gains? The people who own the AI systems? Or the workers who used to do those cognitive tasks?
That's the question Smith raised about capital, the tension between returns to capital and wages to labor, and never fully resolved.
Which Marx then developed into his full theory of capital accumulation. The AI distribution question is the Smithian question that Marx tried to answer, and that we're still arguing about in 2026.
The Smithian answer would be, if the AI markets are competitive, gains diffuse broadly through lower prices and higher real wages. If they're monopolized, gains concentrate. So the policy question is, are the conditions for competition in AI being created, or are we allowing a new East India Company to form?
And looking at the current landscape, the concentration of AI capability in three or four large companies, I think Smith would have been genuinely alarmed.
The infrastructure layer especially. A handful of companies control the compute, the models, the data. Everything built on top of them depends on their terms. That's the kind of structural dependency Smith criticized when the East India Company controlled the trade routes.
Smith believed infrastructure and essential services should be widely accessible. He'd have been very uncomfortable with the idea that the cognitive infrastructure of the global economy runs through a few proprietary systems owned by a few American corporations.
All right, synthesis time. After everything we've covered, after 250 years, what do we take from Adam Smith?
My take, from the economic theory angle, is that Smith is the most important economist who ever lived. Not because he was right about everything, he wasn't. but because he asked the right questions and set the agenda that every economist since has been working on.
What questions?
What creates prosperity? How do markets coordinate dispersed economic activity across millions of actors who will never meet? Under what conditions does self-interest produce social benefit rather than exploitation or monopoly rent? Those questions still define economics.
My take, coming from the moral philosophy angle, is that the most important thing about Smith is that he was both things simultaneously, a moral philosopher and an economic analyst, and that the wealth of nations without the theory of moral sentiments is a dangerous half-read.
Why dangerous?
Because TMS tells you what Smith thought markets were for. Markets work when they're competitive, when they serve people's real needs, when the gains are broadly distributed. WN describes the mechanism. TMS describes the moral conditions under which that mechanism is actually good.
And what strikes me most, historically, is how radical Smith was. He was not defending the powerful. He was attacking them. The East India Company. The merchant guilds. The landlords living on inherited privilege. He was the outsider with a better idea about how the economy should work.
He wrote at a moment when the established economic interests were monopolists and rent seekers, not competitive entrepreneurs. Attacking those interests in 1776 was genuinely dangerous. The wealth of nations was a political act as much as an intellectual one. The modern invocation of Smith as the patron saint of corporate power, of deregulation that benefits incumbent businesses, is almost the exact mirror image of what he actually stood for.
He was for competitive markets that serve workers and consumers. He was against concentrated power in any form, whether from government monopoly in 1776 or corporate monopoly in 2026.
He was wrong about some things. The labor theory of value in the form he held it. His underestimation of how industrial capitalism would transform power dynamics. His inability to anticipate externalities at industrial and atmospheric scale.
But the core insight, that voluntary exchange coordinated through prices in genuinely competitive markets can produce broad prosperity without a central planner, that holds. In 2026, with central planning having failed and economic nationalism on the march, that core holds as firmly as it did in 1776.
The question for our time is what it takes to make markets actually work. Not just asserting that markets are good in principle, but asking, do the actual conditions exist? Competition. Reasonable information. No catastrophic externalities. When those conditions hold, markets work remarkably well. When they don't, the Smithian move is to restore them.
Not to abandon the framework. To enforce its preconditions.
Read The Wealth of Nations, but read The Theory of Moral Sentiments first. The man who wrote both was a moral philosopher who cared deeply about working people, distrusted concentrated power in all its forms, and would have been profoundly uncomfortable being claimed by either side of today's political arguments.
The real Adam Smith is more interesting, more contradictory, and more useful than the icon. He always is.
Thanks for listening. If you want to read Smith himself, start with The Pin Factory, Chapter 1, then The Butcher, Brewer, Baker. Then find The Invisible Hand in Book 4, and read it in its actual context. It will change what you thought you knew.
And if this is your entry point to the series, we've covered Marx, Hayek, and the Austrian school. Smith is the foundation all of them are arguing on or arguing against. Now you have the foundation.
See you next time on Claude Talks.